sabrosura, papi, que qué.
Hello, everyone. This is Pam, de Café con Pam, the bilingual podcast that features Latine and people of the global majority who break barriers, change lives, and make this world a better place. Welcome to episode 344 of Café con Pam. Today, we have a conversation with Dr. Sonila Sedaras. Dr. Sonila is an Albanian-born clinical psychologist who emigrated to the U.S. in 1999, leaving her family behind to pursue higher education. Sonila is sought after for her expertise on a range of topics, including complex trauma, addiction, social anxiety, panic attacks, depression, perfectionism, stress, and self-compassion. For the past 16 years, Sonila has worked in numerous of inpatient psychiatric hospitals and outpatient mental health clinics in Detroit, Michigan, and Chicago, Illinois. Currently, Sonila is the owner of Sedaras Psych and Associates. It's a private practice and works with a team of psychologists. They serve higher functioning adults suffering from panic attacks, social anxiety, work and relationship stress, gender identity issues, grief, loss, and life transitioning. And she is best known for her talks regarding self-compassion, addressing higher functioning professionals and audiences throughout the U.S. and Europe. Sonila is also the founder of a nonprofit organization, Care for Albania, helping children and older people age in Albania. Listeners, this conversation with Sonila was really deep, I would say. We went into so many various topics that I think lots of people can resonate with. Of course, she came in from the immigrant experience, and we shared and talked a lot about compassion and acceptance. And so if you are in a place where perhaps you may be going through something that feels a little hard, this episode might give you some support. Even from just listening to someone who has gone through a difficult journey, this is one of those episodes that will leave you thinking. And perhaps I almost wanted to pause when Sonila would say something. I would be like, wow, we need to like repeat that. And so I hope that all her knowledge and wisdom that she shares with us, I hope that you get to also enjoy it as much as I did. Y bueno, sin más, here's my conversation with Sonila Sedaras. All right. Well, Sonila, welcome to Café con Pam.
So happy to be here.
Yeah. The question we always ask is, what is your heritage?
I am 100% Albanian, born and raised there.
And when did you come to the U.S.?
I came here about 25 years ago. That was 1999.
Wow. It's been a minute, right?
It's been a long time.
So when it comes, how does someone from Albania decide to come to the U.S.? What made you make that decision?
I don't think it was more of a decision. It was more of a ticket to opportunity for me and my family. You know, my background is I was born and raised in a communist government. And then during the transition, it was really tough economically and safety in Albania. So, of course, I wanted to study abroad. And that way I could just make it happen and then either stay there or come back. You know, it wasn't really clear. So the way I left was I had an opportunity to get to US with lots of financial, you know, requirements on my parents' end. So they paid everything they had and they sent me to US to make it happen. So it was a choice for making my dreams reality and taking advantage of that opportunity, but also a big loss of leaving my country and what I knew.
For sure. Did you leave by yourself or did your family come with?
No, I left by myself. I was the only one that could leave and got the ticket. And Really hard time. I actually vividly remember when I got on the plane, and my parents would say now that we thought it felt like we threw you in the middle of the ocean and you'd not come
Oof.
back.
Whoa. That's tough.
Well, and keep in mind, because I left with a visa, I couldn't really come back. So I had that limitation. I couldn't go back and forth as I pleased.
Right. And how, so it's a long trip. And because you came with, so it was a student visa, right? So that meant that it's much more regulated as far as, the reasons why you would enter and exit the country.
Exactly. It wasn't only regulated in that way, but I would, if I wasn't a student and if I applied outside of the student visa, then that meant that I had to be in US until and if I got the green card and then ultimately the passport.
So, given that basically it was just you, where did you decide to go? How was that process of first from getting the idea of, I guess I'm going to leave my country to get better opportunities, to finding the school? How did you decide where to go? And all of that process, how long did it take?
I mean, the process itself of going was not, it was more of like a business transaction. You pay this much money, you go as a student. I think I was completely oblivious of what I was expecting. Like a lot of immigrants, you see US with high rises and beautiful places, and you think you're just going to land there and, it's going to be good. And I'm grateful for that I had that faith, because if I didn't, I don't know if I would have even done it. But what happened is, on my way to US, I've decided to, instead of going as a student at this particular place, I actually went to a few relatives that I knew, to kind of like find a way to make it in US. And the struggles of going to a family that I don't know if I was really wanted there. It was more of like a burden to them. It put me in a situation where I felt very alone, even more alone than if I were by myself, because then you also have this family that's not really supporting. Not only it's not supporting your dreams, but to a point that it was emotionally abusive.
I could relate. I had a similar experience when I moved to college. I went to a small town and ended up leaving with an uncle, and I ended up leaving and moving by myself because it was so hard. So I understand.
Yes, I mean, we might have really similar stories. It was my uncle, and I don't want to mention it so openly, but it's unfortunate, because when you're raised in a family with different rules and regulations, and you're kind of like an adult and you spread your wings open and you want to explore life. I had someone, my uncle was very strict, and in a way that would put me down my dream, big dreams. And I'm so glad that I dreamed big, because look where I am. But it felt very different from my own family. And then how do you navigate those waters, right? Like, you're taking care of me, but also you're not. So I had to leave, just like you did, after 6 months.
Yeah, it was very similar. And how was it during this time? Because I remember when it happened to me, how was it for your parents to have these conversations and them being so far away? And how do they support you? And how do you continue to support yourself also on a student visa? That must have been really hard.
It was really hard. I mean, I came, like I said, in 1999, was before 9/11, and I did do some jobs that, I could get paid, but without my Social Security, because I couldn't use it to survive. So I did clean some houses, and I, babysat. And the unfortunate part is, I love my parents and they're really great people. But I don't think they had a clue what I was going through, from the relationship I had with my uncle and his family to working so hard. They felt for me, but they felt helpless because we were so far away. They could not go and get a visa and help me. And I could not just go and run to them. I actually could have, but it wasn't an option on my book. Mm. It felt like I need to make this happen.
For sure.
Yeah, I lived in inner city of Detroit. I lived in an apartment where, you know, it's only one room and you'll make do with what you have. That wasn't really the problem. I think that, you know, Michigan, where I went because of my relatives, is a state that you really need to drive. If you can't drive, you can't really survive, even like by going to work. There is no public transportation. Of course, I come from Europe where we walked everywhere. So I remember I found this bike that was beaten and I would drive it in winter, summer, fall, during rain, during snow, to go to the family where I would babysit or clean houses, 7 or 8 miles, and then come back afterwards and then go to the other job. I mean, it's not uncommon for immigrants to just do 2-3 jobs and just keep on working, right? Like, I don't think I'm the exception here.
For sure. I think it's just one of those things that for immigrants is something, and even children of immigrants, is something that's so common that we don't even talk about it because it's like, oh yeah, and you know, that was a normal thing that we had to do.
Right, exactly. And that's why I want to honor the struggling of my life and sharing it with your listeners, but also to give hope to immigrants that are in these situations now. I mean, across my office, you can see, but there is a community of Venezuelans that, you know, have traveled so far to get here. And I see people helping, but at the same time, I want to give them the hope of dream big and you're going to make this happen. And then also I want to do some practical things for individuals, either with knowledge or with like actual help, besides knowledge, to get a leg up, because we all need that, especially immigrants.
And I think something that something that happens to a lot of immigrants is because we learn to be resilient in so many ways that it's almost hard to ask for help. And so having organizations and people like you and others who are helping is important, because sometimes, like, it's also the privacy thing that happens with the immigrants, that it's like, oh, everything we keep inside and we don't talk about it. We'll get to the mental health piece.
Yeah.
You know, it's important to talk about it.
Absolutely. I mean, I think that I had struggled myself with like opening up, especially the first 10 years of my life. It was kind of like, if you met me then, you'd be like, who are you? Different people. But I think that there is a strength when it comes to healing through trauma. And because that's what it is, you know, a lot of immigrants and our ancestors, and the more intersectionalities we have, the more challenges we have had. Now, of course, that makes you resilient. And of course, there's a light at the end of the tunnel. However, it can also keep on going. You know, I am the only family member, I can say that broke the chain for so many reasons, from being in this field to asking for my own help, mental health, to doing things differently, where I broke the chain of, that doesn't mean you're loyal if you keep things hush-hush, especially when it comes to mental health or to suffering. That doesn't mean you're loyal. It means something that, hey, you haven't trusted the environment in the past. And I get it why you don't want to share, because it feels vulnerable and you're worried you're going to get hurt, which you could very easily get. At the same time, if you find the strength within and you do compassionate work within, you tend to be softer with yourself and others. And also those self-judgments or that shame and that guilt, what other people are going to say, gets more quiet. So your voice can be heard, your resiliency can be heard, your accomplishments. And then, of course, giving hope to others.
Totally. I love that. And I think that's a struggle that a lot of first, second, third generations listeners that tune in, because I've received the messages when they're like, you know, I feel bad for being successful, or I feel that survivor's guilt or success guilt, I guess. What would you say to them?
I mean, I think that is a narrative that's probably born with you, most likely, and within the culture and within who you are. I think that when you come from a collectiveness, it makes sense to kind of like see it as like, I don't, you know, I'm just like doing these things for me, but what about the rest? I, from my experience and as a clinician, I have not met anyone, including myself, that have accomplished at a larger level besides surviving, but that has thrived without being compassionate about themselves. And I speak about self-compassion quite a lot, because that is, it's that self-compassion towards myself that I actually had to learn for me first before I treat clients and do these kind of speakings. I didn't have it in me. My self-esteem and my self-worth was really tied to how can I help others, which in a collective society and as a woman, I think it's really promoted. You don't see a lot of people that say, just take care of yourself. Who cares about others? Right. But that doesn't have to be this dichotomy between take care of yourself, don't care about others. It can mean, and I talk to folks all the time about this, self-compassion means you're not a burden on someone else. So if that kind of like change narrative helps you or others, then that's how I see it. If you think about our parents, they've done so much for us, and we do so much for our kids and for our communities. If I'm not taking care of me, nobody can actually get what I have to give. It's that mind shift of you owe it to yourself to be kind, including the rest of the world. And if you're being harsh on yourself, it's the same as if you're being harsh to someone else.
Totally. How did you discover the power of compassion? Because you mentioned that you started with yourself. So what happened?
Yeah. I think it was through suffering, through lots of suffering. I think I already had compassion for others. I don't think I put myself in that equation. And then now we know, if you think about Native Americans or a lot of tribes, they focus a lot on love, kindness within. And then they share that with the world, from plant medicine to positive reinforcement to being there for others. So for me, it was the opposite. I had the compassion for others. I grew up in an environment where my grandmother, my great-grandmother, my mom did so much about the community. So that part was easy. What I didn't know or didn't learn is that where do I come into the equation? And so I've been here for almost 25 years, and only the last 10 years have shaped me to be who I am today. So one of the stories I share, and I actually keep in mind close to my heart, is the suffering of my family separation. Since we already had trauma through separating due to immigration and not being able to see each other for years, I felt like we were in a good place where everyone came here and had documentation. And of course, during Trump era, my brother got deported. And that opened such a big pain in my heart and old wound of 25 years or 15 years at the time. And for the first time, instead of getting busy, like a lot of immigrants or women, immigrant women do, I actually allowed the pain. I welcomed it in a way of crying and doing meditations and doing heart space and caring for that painful either little girl or 19-year-old girl or painful community of immigrants. So that time, it took me some time to accept it. But it's not that I wasn't accepting it. It's that I was really processing the pain within myself. And it was a relationship between just me and I that I needed to focus on. And that was my, I call it awakening. And of course, I'm not awoke because it's a lifelong journey. But it was something that was different from other times. Because even as a therapist or as a friend or as a mother, I started relating to the world with such compassion that was even more so than before, because now I included myself in it.
Mm-hmm.
And so that's when I realized that, at least for me and how I, what I want to share with the world, is that that self-compassion is as important as compassion for others. And if it's not happening, it's only half of the compassion being done, half of the job being done.
Ooh, because it starts with the self. That's what I'm hearing.
Right. And the self is also us, if we're interconnected. So you can neglect a part of your body and say, I don't need my left leg because I have my right one.
It won't work that way.
No, we want a whole. And we are a whole when we actually think about ourselves and others as one.
I'm sorry that happened to your family. Mine went through another parallel of that. And so I understand.
It's like we have a lot in common.
Yeah, for sure. Mine was just during Obama.
During Obama, yeah. I think that with a dreamer, a lot of the legalities that we don't understand, we haven't gone to school for it. You need to just constantly study with immigration laws, right? I just think that there is a lot of pain in the immigrant community that also, you know, there is a lot of resilience, like you said. So I want to focus on changing the sufferings into making your dreams and your life happen. And it doesn't matter immigrants or not, different intersectionalities. But when it comes to immigrants, once you go through it yourself, through that pain and that separation, that inability to not have the option to go back home, or to get your documents here, even though you're paying taxes. You know, it feels home to me.
For sure. I think this conversation will definitely give a lot of reflecting thoughts to the listeners, because sometimes what I see, and for myself having gone through that process, is in when you call it, you know, that's kind of like an awakening of it shakes you up so much that you just have to do something. How could people not get hard? Because sometimes the resentment comes, because what I'm hearing is like, there's the awareness first, as compassion is kind of like entering, you have to be aware of the suffering that's going through and accepting it. How could we move into compassion and not becoming resentful or like angry, or do we just process that also?
Yeah. I mean, the question is not how do we not get hard, because we already are. You know, this is from like our ancestors trying to have us survive. That's why we are here today talking. The question is, how do you actually attend to that pain of within yourself that it's easy to get busy and avoid? And most people are not doing this intentionally, but the busyness, especially in this country where there are so many distractions, you know, first and foremost, work, survival. And a lot of people tie work with self-worth, which is not healthy for anyone. But what do you have outside of work? Now, if you choose to binge watching TV, which I'm not judging anyone by any, I do it from time to time, you're not really attending and bringing that finger as a U-turn towards your heart and what's going on with me, what is hurting within my body. A lot of the hardened parts of ourselves stay stuck in our bodies. And we need the intention to actually focus in us so we can attend to that painful either memory or event or that rumination that we keep ourselves into resentment, for example. When you are resenting someone or the world, and you have every right to, I think that that's completely a normal feeling to have, having a harsh life or someone hurt you or something hurting you. What most people don't know is that our bodies do not know if you're upset at someone else or if someone is upset at you.
Ooh.
Right? So I think that, and we know that with data and everything, with research, your body, your heart rate goes up, the cortisol levels increase, you feel stressed through that resentment. So when I want to help people and when people want to change, this is a pivot point during my time with them or these speaking engagements, because if your body doesn't know, what you're really doing is you're hurting yourself over and over again. And that person that hurt you does not even hear you. And also that situation is not really changing. So
right.
How do we switch that I'm hardened because life has hardened me to life has hardened me and I'm going to heal myself? I owe this to myself because nobody else will heal me.
Yeah, that's the question, the million-dollar question.
Yeah, so then that, you know, instead of blaming other situations, which you could be 100% right, this situation, this is not fair. Why did this happen to me? How about you turn that towards yourself? Where is this hurting? What does this part need? And how can I attend to it? And that seems easy, but it's really hard to sit through it because we're used to doing something when we don't feel good.
Right. Numbing.
And it's not about doing. It's about being. Yes, doing is numbing. It's like an addiction. Being is like, oh, crap. Now I need to like really deal with this. Like, what's going on with me? Why am I feeling anxious when I'm sitting and resting? Oh, because there is stuff underneath there that you need to attend. So it's a life full of ancestor pain and your pain.
Totally. And, you know, I often have conversations around this topic, and on YouTube specifically, I have received comments like, you need to stop looking at the past and just look forward to the future and like stop focusing on whatever whoever did to you, just like take action into what's next. What would you respond to that?
I think it's so much easier to say that in theory and so much harder to do it. It's almost like telling someone in a relationship, you got to leave him, you got to leave her. You know, it's such an easy answer. It's a cop out, I think. Although ultimately, I would hope that that person gets better within them and doesn't have that negative that hurts their own body, which now we know, you know, physical health is directly correlated to our emotional well-being. No wonder why, you know, cancer is on the rise, heart attacks are on the rise. But it's not that people don't understand that. You know, if people say that to you or someone else, it's almost borderline offensive because most people are intelligent enough to understand that and say, hey, I know if I eat donuts, I'm going to gain weight or it's not going to be healthy for me. Right? So if I don't think about this, it's going to be better for me. How do I get myself to stop that? And that is, which is not one thing, it's a whole process. I think it starts with first recognizing that, yes, you have been hurt, and recognizing that your narrative to this point has been helpful for your past. Is it helpful for now? I usually screen people and say, is this narrative helping you now? No, it's not. Then I start talking about how they can start healing within themselves and be their own healer and empower themselves that you are not just a victim. You're a survivor and you're a thriver. And even if we have one day left, we should still strive for that. But it's not such an easy process that, you know, I'll tell you, forget about all this, stop obsessing with your uncle or your past. And after this hour, you're going to be like, wow, you didn't even get me. I don't know how to do that because there is a right. part of our brain that's called the obsessiveness in us that ruminates So our thoughts come to us. We don't invite them. What we can do is to see those thoughts as a movie. And in fact, this was going to be one of the something to give back to your community. And I loved Novik's place, by the way. That was so funny. It made me laugh. But, you know, holding on to that story and seeing and replaying the same movie means your body is getting hurt and getting stressed ongoingly. Once we put that movie to pause, not stop, because you might not be able to stop, but pause it from time to time. So my approach is usually you create pausing moments. You create moments of stop thinking about it, if you can. You create moments of distractions. Then you introduce new things on how to deal with that pain, because it's still there. That rumination is there. How do you take your thoughts, pause them, and then bring new ones to replace those thoughts? So it's a long process, and it's also a process of grieving. You know, nobody can tell someone, you got to stop, it's not good for you. It's like someone, you know, has a death in the family, and you're like, okay, you got 6 months. And actually in US, it's only 2 months in our field. After 2 months, you're just depressed as a person, which I completely disagree, obviously. But it's a grieving process that needs compassion with yourself, needs you to be patient. And definitely, you do not want to hear when people say, get over it. It's best. This is what's best for you, because it's a logical interpretation. We don't have a problem with logic. We have a problem with emotions, because there is a mind feel happening here that you don't know about me and I don't know about you. So if we could start with just refrain from giving advice, unless you've done it and you have 1,000 other people that have done it after you.
Right. And even then, I would say every person is different. And to your point of like the grieving process, even I've also gone through various processes of grieving various things, not just people that have passed in my life, but even previous parts of myself that they don't reflect who I am. And I think giving ourselves permission to accept that part of us that at some point existed is it's another step forward to giving ourselves that compassion that you talk about.
That is the compassion, you know, allowing yourself to feel. Because we tend to think that, how do I get from point A to point B? And I have so many clients that say that, and they outsmart me from an intelligence point of view in their field anytime. So, you know, it's not a linear process, and it's not a path that I can give everyone. Or the path that I took, I cannot say that, Pam, you do this and you're going to be saved or healed. It's about getting to know ourselves and peeling the onion and knowing what makes us tick, what served us, what doesn't serve us. And it's an ongoing process. It's for the rest of our lives. Mm.
Totally. Why do you think it's so scary for people to even think about exploring this process? But don't answer. We're going to go to a quick coffee break and then we'll come back and answer that question. So, Sunila, do you drink coffee?
I drink some coffee, but one a day is more than enough for me.
Nice.
I'll get some water.
And are you a daily coffee drinker or just like?
I would drink it every day. Yeah, getting older, I think it affects me. It makes me a little bit more like on edge with the caffeine. I have a low tolerance.
Yeah. Or you could, I mean, tea.
Tea is, you know, it's not my favorite. I think it's healthier for you, but it's not my favorite. And it goes almost hand in hand on how do you give up something that, you know, might not serve you well, but you really like it or you're used to it. So it's almost like with a topic that we're going to move forward. It's a struggle, but I've gone through like caffeine, decaf, one regular coffee. What about you? It says coffee with con Pam. So I'm assuming you are drinking coffee.
I am drinking coffee. So right now I don't. So I am a morning coffee drinker for sure. It's my daily morning ritual. I do either black or with powdered milk. It's not half and half. I've talked about this extensively. Mm-hmm. So it's either I drink it. If it's black, it's typically a pour over. Or if I go and visit local coffee shops, then I typically get like a latte or something a little bit more mm-hmm. elaborate. But yeah, I'm a daily coffee drinker. And my so I actually, if I drink a very specific kind of coffee, I yeah. don't necessarily have a max that gets me jittery. Mm-hmm. If I drink any like kind of coffee, like if I go to a coffee shop, I can really just have the one cup. Mm-hmm. But for me, as long as I eat, I have food in my belly and I'm drinking water, then I can drink it. The challenge is to not drink it past like 2 o'clock, one, anywhere between 1 and 3 is when it's like, okay, you're done. Otherwise, you're
yeah, it's a stimulant. Even it's such a simple thing. I work mostly with anxiety, you know, and folks that get anxious, including myself, because we're not, you know, immune to it. And it's that getting to know yourself, just like with the pain, the same thing with what we put into our body. And also, the moment you figure it out, the next year or the next 6 months could be different.
Totally. You know what gives me anxiety? Soy, any type of soy. Like anytime I go and eat sushi, which is one of my favorite things to eat, I get anxious afterwards.
Oh, wow. But you see, this
so is bizarre.
It's bizarre and different, but it's also good to know that, you know, mostly people think like caffeine makes you anxious. Who would have thought that soy would give you, make you anxious? But knowing that, I think it's just so important.
I know.
I'm sorry, you're losing on soy and the sushi.
It's really sad, but I do. It's one of those, like, I don't know if you've seen the meme that's like, my toxic trait is eating the food that I know it's not going to make me happy and be like, I wonder if today is going to make me sick and still eat it.
Yeah.
That's me and sushi. It's just so good. And yeah, I love it so much.
It's that grief, right? We go through grief so many times a day that if we, the whole life is full of grief, from a meal to a person to a situation to age.
Yeah, for sure. Oof, so good. Okay, let's get back to the show. Listeners, as you know, I'm a recovering procrastinator. And because of that, I'm often building ways to getting things done. Inside the annual Manny's Pass, we get to embrace our own unique ways of achieving. Together in our weekly office hours and cafecitos, we'll find strength in our differences, accountability in our goals, and power in our voices as we heal our inner child through coaching and tapping. Your choice. Let's redefine productivity on our terms. Visit cafecompam.com/Manny's Pass and join us. Okay, so before we went on break, I asked, why do you think it's so hard for people to embark on this process of compassion,
yeah,
self-compassion?
It's not that it's hard in a sense of that they don't want it and why. It's more of like, why isn't it happening for some people, right? And so we always question, like, what happened to you that you have this awakening moment? I think that it's a very lonely process, first and foremost, and we don't talk enough about it. You know, that self-compassion is not something that you press a button or you have a path on how to do it. You just, in my, you know, obviously this is an opinion, but I think that everyone has to have their own time on how to do it. For me, wasn't even moving in US, maybe it was, but for me, I mentioned it was when my brother got deported. That's when everything fell apart. And the deeper the pain, the deeper the work with myself.
Oof. That's deep.
And I also was pausing at the time, just so you know. I was pausing. I was not busy. When I moved here, I was very busy having 2-3 jobs, trying to survive. But that's why that process of self-compassion is challenging, because A, it's a one person's job. You'll be alone. Nobody will really understand it. and the whole process that they're going through, grief, scary, unfamiliar, what are others are going to say? Some people fight you on that because you're the only one changing in your family or in your group of friends. And then the other piece is, and when I work with abuse, you know, if you think about not having self-compassion, it's a little bit of self-abusive behavior because you're being harsh on yourself, like someone else that raised you or someone that scolded you growing up. When I work with women that have been abused or with addiction, I know there is a lot of this, I'm scared. I'd rather continue with what's familiar or be with this person than be out there in the unknown.
Oof.
You know, we don't do well with, let me explore on this path and this change, right? We don't do well with change. So we don't do well with like, I don't know how this side is going to be, but I'm going to give it a try. So it takes a boldness within you and a strong desire and faith. And I'm not even talking about religion, faith, religious faith, faith within, I know myself and I have a vision and I want to do that. So it's a matter of, if you're not uncomfortable enough, I don't think a lot of people dive into it. And so I encourage people to welcome change and know that it's not going to be easy. But is the process of not being self-compassion easy? And is this working for you? So there is a lot of, like, from different points, you got to see the complexity of that. Complexity of this self-compassion, right? And it's not, again, a path that I can teach people. It's more of, I can sprinkle a few things I know, and hopefully you practice and you do other things to, I mean, without a practice, even for me, I've noticed anytime I don't practice meditation or pausing or resting, that's when my old self comes in. I usually call myself a retired perfectionist, but it comes to play from time to time, which perfectionism is a recipe for suffering sometimes, right? So it's easy. It's not easy to answer this question because I hope I answered it in a way that be patient with yourself and search for something that's different and makes you feel good, even if it's not familiar.
Yeah, it's a hard one for sure because it's. Humans are so different from each other that there isn't, you know, like a blanket statement that you could say. It's one of those, like, when you're ready type things, I think.
Yeah. Yeah. And each step in life, each struggling and suffering, things that we don't understand were in it. I believe that that's, you know, it's an opportunity for you to either step in the unknown or step in the being familiar, and then the outcome will depend on those two things. And then, of course, within comes fear versus love, which one takes over, you know? So fear is something that our primitive brain constantly focused on. Am I safe? Am I safe? Nowadays we are not, well, we're still not that sophisticated. We have plenty of wars in the world, but we, when someone hurts us, we go in as like, my safety is threatened. And then you have that fear-based mentality where you don't really do something new because you're afraid. You're going to fail, or you're going to be alone, or you're going to not survive. But if you go in with that love space in our heart, once you attend to yourself, once you actually start creating a circle that is positive for you, then it's easy to say, I'm going to give this a try, and I'm going to believe in myself. But I don't have those expectations that if I fail, it's going to be bad. It's just trying it out. And that's how I get to know myself.
Yes. Be curious. So let's flip it a little bit. So you mentioned what happens when people stay in toxic or even abusive relationships, and the familiar many times is the safest. So my question is for the people that love the person who's staying, because I also have seen the, maybe it's a lack of compassion or acceptance of where the person that is staying is. How could a friend or a loved one still support the person while not being dismissive of their journey? Because to your point, you mentioned it earlier, like sometimes you just say, well, get over it, or like leave that person. But
yeah, I mean, this is very, very familiar, right? Because it's easier for us to say to someone we love, stop this relationship, versus to sit with those feelings. And I think that this process, sometimes it's more about how the person feels, meaning the other person, seeing a loved one getting hurt. Mm. I think that the first thing that I would suggest is to gain some insight that is not really about you saving the other person. It's about you seeing that person and accepting their situation for where they're at. This is for a couple of reasons. If you go in with a solution, you're being very dismissive of the person's suffering. Again, most people know intellectually where they should live or when they should not. But also, nobody really knows your relationship with that person or with that situation. Nobody fully knows that. So we have to be very careful when we give advice, because we can come across as dismissive and non-validating. And then that person feels even more lonely that way. Or we can come across as we're judging them, which I'm sure there is judgment there, or shaming them for not doing the right thing. It's so interesting when those people or someone that can give that advice, and they mean well, by the way, I know that most people mean well. If you flip the script and now that person is in your shoes, they might be doing exactly the same thing, or maybe not. But like you said, people are different. I think we need more people that can just be with us through the process of healing or getting out of the relationship, or even healing the relationship. Mm-hmm. You know, I feel like, you know, relationships are hard. If we're talking about relationships, either friendship or intimate relationships sometimes are harder, because whatever mind feel you have, now it's doubled. You have two people with different triggers. So when people talk about communication and we're not getting along, and communication is such a buzzword, because it's not that people don't know how to talk. It's that I cannot see your pain, and you might not be able to translate that or to identify where it is and how it is. So you need to dig deep with curiosity and love for that person and patience to get somewhere.
Oof. So good.
I just think that it's best for people to pause, ask the other person, what do you need? And leave it at that. And if they need, I need your support to help me get out of this, then how do we do that together? But mm-hmm. It's not for us to judge and put a timeline on someone else's story.
Totally. I love that. Well, we're running out of time, so I want to make sure we get to share all the things. Tell us all the places and spaces where we can find you, all the things.
Well, I am the founder of careforalbania.org. It's a nonprofit foundation that I've opened for people back home to help children, mostly children with disability, and elderly, our wise population. You could also find me if you need coaching, treatment, consultation, on www.chicagopsych.org. That is one of our practices here in the city of Chicago, but we work internationally and nationwide with folks that need help. And the other practice is Chicago Anxiety Center Supervision and Consultation.
Amazing.
The phone number would be 872-529-1980, and email would be sonilasejdaras@gmail.com. The other email that I can respond quicker, it's more of a personal, but I would welcome the audience to email is dr.sedaras, my last name, at gmail.org. I mean, .com, sorry. So many orgs and coms.
Yes. And we'll have everything in the show notes or in the description. If you're watching this in YouTube, it will be in the description. If you are tuning in on the podcast, everything will be in the show notes, so you don't have to worry about stressing writing it down. We got you there. Okay. Well, Dr. Sonila, thank you so much for coming to Café con Pam. Last few questions. Do you have a remedy that you want to share with us?
Yes. This is one of the things that I kind of want to share with the audience in terms of how do you handle conflict and when you're in the midst of the conflict and don't want to do something that or say something that you will regret later on. I have three steps. The first step is remove yourself, but of course, let the person know I need a break. Please respect my break. Don't just walk out because that can feel rejection and abandonment. Two, calm yourself through deep breathing exercises. I usually ask people to put one hand on their chest, one hand on their belly. The belly should be the one that moves on and off with air. The reason for that is because when we bring more oxygen into our body, which would be our belly, our lungs expand, we bring more oxygen into our brain. We calm down that way. So sometimes when people say I'm breathing, they might be breathing through their chest. They bring only half of their oxygen and they're not really relaxing. They're more ventilating or like, right? And so three, then within 24 hours, if possible, address the topic in a more calm, cool, and collected way. So that way that will save you, create some separation, will save you some time to build a way of communicating your needs or your triggers in a way that's more structured and you're more in control versus if we speak from anger or frustration, then we regret it and shame and guilt sips in. So you can avoid that for yourself.
For sure. I love that framework. And yeah, it made me think of like, you literally want to sleep on it.
Yes, those 24 hours when people say sleep on it, it's actually a good thing. There is research that's being done, especially with couples, and it's not only heterosexual couples, it's any couple, that if you actually pause, your true self comes to surface because we lose ourselves when we go into trauma mode or crisis mode or anger mode. And so the frontal lobe comes back after some time, and that's when the real Sonila or Pam is coming to surface. It's not when we react.
Right. For sure. So listeners, sleep on it for sure and do all the steps. And do you have a quote or mantra that you live by?
I do. I usually tend to talk to myself, I'm here for you. I love you. I think that mantra is really important in terms of self-care and in terms of emotionally independence, because I feel like at the end of the day, even though we are interconnected, we first have to take care of ourselves. We know and get to know ourselves more than anyone else. So that mantra of I'm here for you, I love you, is a reminder of the compassion towards myself. And then I can keep on going and be compassionate and giving to others.
I love that. The last question. Do you have a productivity tip, trick, or tool that you want to share with us?
Yes. Take breaks. I know that it sounds crazy because a lot of people feel like, well, how can I be productive if I'm taking a break? I'm tying it with psychology. Okay, the way our brain works, we have autonomic nervous system. One is part of fight, flight, freeze, where sympathetic nervous system is on, and that can get exhausting. It's almost like a car running without changing the oil or tires or anything. And the parasympathetic nervous system, which is rest and digest, and not a lot of people are putting it into use. the way you put it into use is by stretching, going for some water, pausing, turn off the computer and close your eyes for 1 minute. You have to be intentional about this stuff because it's not going to call you. You have to invite it into your life. But the more you pause, the more productive you can be. The more you actually break your projects, the more productive you can be.
Proven that.
The Nordic countries got it correctly. They work only 4 days a week and they're doing quite well with productivity.
I agree. I've tried it myself. I try to be now much more diligent with my boundaries and it's working. It's working. And I am much more calm, cool, and collected. So
I'm glad.
Yeah. Okay. Well, Sanila, thank you so much for coming to Cafe con Pam. This was awesome. You're going to leave us.
Thank you for inviting me.
Of course, with so much wisdom and information and food for thought for listeners to then take on and reach out to you and work with you and keep going with their journey. Thank you. Thank you.
Thank you. Listeners, stay shiny.
All right, listeners, we have completed the episode and I really hope you enjoy it. I hope you take some of or a lot of the pieces of the conversation that were shared. I hope you are able to just think about it and I hope they feel supported. If this is conversation, something that you know someone perhaps that might benefit from this conversation, please do share it. It helps a ton when you do share the episode. Another great way to support us is by sharing comments and reviews. It's really helpful, really useful. Thumbs up, stars, all the things, because it really helps others find us and make decisions. Make sure to follow Café con Pam on all the places and spaces, Spotify, Apple Podcast, and of course on YouTube. Hit the follow and subscribe button so you are aware and you are the first to know when new episodes drop. I would love to stay connected at Café con Pam Podcast on Instagram and Facebook, at Café con Pam Pod on TikTok, cafeconpam.com for all things Café con Pam, including the awesome Manny's Pass. Check it out. I would love for you to join us. You want to listeners, this is another episode of Café con Pam. Thank you so, so much for being here. I so appreciate you. And I'm on my way to go get a lamp so you stop seeing the glow on my glasses. Bueno, como siempre, stay shining.